KGVM 95.9, KGVM.org. These are the locations for Gallatin Valley's community-based radio. You're listening to the weekly Health and Happiness program hosted by Dr. Suzette Wood, speech-language pathologist, and myself, Dr. Arliss Wood, psychologist. The Public Education Committee of the Montana Psychological Association provides moral support for us. For that, we are thankful. You will be very interested in today's show. Dr. Suzanne will now introduce it.
According to the Pew Research Center, 74% of Americans consider climate change to be a serious problem, and 77% say that it is harming people now. From meteorologist Keith Bryant, we hear that many people are worried about the climate and are seeking help to navigate their emotions. In fact, the American Psychological Association found over two-thirds of Americans have experienced eco-anxiety. In a 2019 survey, eco-anxiety, which is the fear of the effects of climate change, occurs in 60% of all Americans and 59% of young people. It's a chronic, ongoing fear of environmental doom and the associated concern for one's future and that of the next generations. It can take the form of fear, as mentioned, or guilt about the environment, or grief over destroyed habitat and species, or a feeling of hopelessness about the future of the world. Is this worry legitimate? Why should we worry here in Montana? Well, coming from the Montana Wildlife Federation, climate change threatens to radically change Montana's outdoor traditions. 11,000 jobs and $281 million of income are at stake due to stream closures, lost hunting opportunities, wildfires, and reduced snowpack. Less snowpack in the high country means less runoff for our streams. The runoff will come earlier, and streams will run warmer, and we might look at water shortages. How do we address our climate concerns? Today we have with us an eminent geoscientist, Dr. Kathy Whitlock, who can speak to this issue. She's been elected to the National Academy of Sciences. She's received the AMQUA Distinguished Career Award. The Association of Women Geoscientists Professional Excellence Award, the Edmund Wilson Biodiversity Technology Pioneer Award, and the Charles and Nora Wiley Faculty Award for Meritorious Research. Welcome, Kathy. Could you please begin to tell us how you came to this good work and how you earned all of these awards, and maybe how we can think about our environment, perhaps starting with how you got involved?
Well, thank you so much for having me on your show today. I really appreciate the chance to talk to you and to talk about climate change in this region. I study climate change over long time scales as an earth scientist. So I don't think about climate change in my research as it happens over days or years, but rather as it happens over centuries to millennia. And we get this information by getting sediment cores from lakes in Yellowstone and Montana and really in places around the world. And we look at the fossils in the lake mud to reconstruct past ecosystems and then from there reconstruct climate. So that's been my research for decades, and I've published many, many scientific papers on that topic of long-term environmental change, but I think in the last 10 years, I was realizing more and more that all these papers that I published weren't really having much of an impact to broader audiences. They were something the scientific community was interested in, but we were facing so much climate change, and I really wasn't contributing enough in that area. So that got me started on doing climate assessment work.
I'm so glad that you did, because we're all searching for some answers here. And how did you become interested in this work, Kathy?
Well, you know, maybe I should start by just saying what a climate assessment is. A climate assessment is a synthesis of the best available scientific information at the time of publication. So, you know, there's so much good science out there, but who reads it and who knows that it exists and it's not always easy to understand. So an assessment, it tries to summarize that information and put it into language that hopefully most people can understand. You know, we say we write it for eighth grade level, but, you know, honestly, there's some really smart eighth graders and there's some really, you know, maybe not so smart adults. So we're just trying to shoot for a level that people can read and understand what the best science says. There's been assessments for decades now at the international level. You probably know the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change produces a report every 4 to 5 years looking at the state of the globe and how climate change is affecting the world. Just recently, the U.S. Global Change Research Program released the latest national climate assessment, and that looks at the U.S. as a whole and looks at sort of regions. So we're in the north central region. And the problem is I felt like we weren't getting information that was local enough to be really useful to people in Montana and in the greater Yellowstone region. And so that's what motivated me to work with a team to develop the first Montana climate assessment, which came out in 2017. We followed up with a special report on climate change and human health. And then more recently, we did a climate assessment for the greater Yellowstone ecosystem.
So glad that you're looking at these areas in particular. And could you maybe run through some of your findings for us, Kathy?
Well, they're all fairly consistent, which is good because they're kind of in the same. It would be shocking if they weren't. But I mean, the main thing in Montana and in Greater Yellowstone, which is our area of Bozeman, is that it's getting warmer. Since 1950s, we've seen 2 to 3 degrees Fahrenheit warming. So it's much warmer now than it was then. And when I talk to the public, I think most people that have lived in Montana or in the greater Yellowstone region, you know, appreciate that. They recognize that too. Because it's getting warmer, we're seeing less snow. We get more of our precipitation as rain rather than snow, and the snow melts earlier, which means that we lose our reservoirs of water that carry us into the summer. Because that's our snowpack, and that's leading us into drier summers. So we've seen really rapid shifts between sort of warm, wet springs to warm, dry summers in the last few years. That's really quite concerning. So yeah. Those are a couple of the findings, and we can talk about it more as you wish.
Yeah, the Montana Institute for Ecosystems was stating that fires have increased. The fire season is longer, and forest carbon is being lost due to the decreasing snowpack. And so there's a lot of agreement with those statements you just made across the board, it looks like.
Yeah, if you think about it, warmer temperatures, less of the precipitation falls as snow, more as rain, It melts sooner, it melts faster, and we go into summer being drier. So that sets us up for a whole bunch of things. It sets us up for more wildfires. And, you know, we thought the Yellowstone fires in 1988 were a big deal. But honestly, we've seen ever larger fires somewhere in the West or in North America almost every year since then. I mean, fires are getting alarmingly larger than we've seen before. So wildfires are part of the consequence of climate change. We've also seen that our streams in summertime are not as full, the flows are lower, and the temperatures are warmer. So we've had more days when people can't go fishing, you know, or the fishing gets closed in the afternoon because it's not healthy for the fish. And that's a consequence of climate change. And then, of course, people that work in agriculture have noticed that by the end of the summer, many years, there are really serious water shortages, and crops that depend on irrigation, it really requires some decision-making as to how that's going to be accomplished, or how are cattle going to be cool enough in the evenings to be healthy, and all kinds of agricultural issues.
Yeah.
So a lot of that, I go back to saying a lot of that is the result of just warming in this region and the consequences it has on everything.
Yeah. Again, the Institute on Ecosystems points out that the increased numbers of days 90 degrees and over impacts the wheat crop and stresses livestock. Mm-hmm. Also that winter annual weeds will increase. So it's an odd coming together of different kinds of problems, but all related to weather changes.
Yeah, and I should say the Montana Institute on Ecosystems, where I've been based for a long time, they're the ones that produce these assessments. They are, and so they're drawing information that's directly from the Montana Climate Assessment and from the Greater Yellowstone Assessment and from the Human Health and Climate Change Report. So I hope people will go to that site and look at these documents.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. They actually show, too, that climate change is aggravating 58% of infectious diseases. It exacerbates those illnesses that we've always had with us, but it's making them worse and more widespread. It's aggravated 160 unique diseases they've been able to research, and this is leading the way to amplifying some of the pathogenic diseases like cholera, Lyme disease, West Nile virus, and others. And so also the droughts and floods that come with warming bring people closer to pathogens, for instance, if there's a flood. So it's something that we all need to pay attention to. And tell us about how you go about going to Yellowstone and coming up with information that helps us with this, Kathy.
Well, when you look at the past, you're always trying to see if it's different than the present and how it's going to compare with the future as we project it from models. So in other words, are we moving into uncharted territory now, or have we seen similar conditions in the past? And I think, you know, it makes us all feel better if we know that, you know, we're not in uncharted territory, that we actually have experienced periods of extreme warming or wildfire and so on in our history. That information's getting a little bit more, I think, scary. We know, for example, that Old Faithful stopped erupting in the 13th century. In Yellowstone, it was just simply too dry for the water to get into the geyser plumbing system and get pressurized to produce geysers. So that's kind of shocking, because the projections for the future suggest that that may happen again as we move into drier summers and so on. We also know that the levels of carbon dioxide that we have in the atmosphere globally right now, we haven't had carbon dioxide at this high a level for about 3.3 million years. 3.3 million years. You have to go way back in time. And if you go back to those geologic periods, you can see that they're hot and they're humid. There's no ice cap in Greenland or West Antarctica. Sea levels 10 to 15 feet higher. I mean, it's a different world. And if our present day gets in equilibrium with the levels of CO2 in our atmosphere, we're going to look at some major changes.
Wow. And what would you say is the main driver of these changes and this warming, Kathy?
Well, I think, as you said in your opening, most people know the cause of global warming. It's the increased emissions of greenhouse gases, particularly through the burning of fossil fuels. It's not really a crime story where we're trying to figure out who's the culprit. We know the cause of global warming. It's pretty straightforward, and it's pretty clear what we have to do. We have to reduce emissions of greenhouse gases. We have to get to net zero carbon emissions, hopefully by the middle of the century.
You know, I was looking at a Pew Research article where they asked people across the United States about this topic. And it was interesting that two-thirds of U.S. adults say the country should prioritize developing renewable energy resources, such as wind and solar, over expanding oil, coal, and natural gas. So people, I think, are starting to get the idea of what's going on. Have you noticed that, Kathy, in your work?
Yeah, I think those are super positive findings. You know, people now recognize that there's a problem. As you said, about 74% of the country recognizes it and wants to do something. And there's now a lot of investment in technologies that will help reduce our greenhouse gas emissions and our carbon footprint. So I think that's all really positive. I think, it's got to come as fast as it can, because we really need to take action in the next 10 to 15 years if we're going to have any effect on warming. It's also interesting that these national surveys, though, when you ask people, will climate change impact me? That's the question. Will climate change impact me? I think in Gallatin County, it's like 45%. That's also about Montana's percentage. 45% do not think climate change will affect them. So in other words, they see it as a problem, but they don't really see how it's going to impact them. They don't see it as their problem. And I think that's why these assessments are so important, because they give people the information and the tools to have that conversation of how climate change is going to impact them. As a scientific community, we've done a great job on convincing people that polar bears are in danger and that sea level's rising and there's going to be more hurricanes, but we don't do such a good job of explaining what does it mean for Montana.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting, too, the Pew Research was pretty broad-reaching, and politically, and according to age, there are dichotomies. In other words, there are great differences among the groups. Younger people, by far, they gave the percentages, feel that this is a really unique and current and real problem, where 80% of older people do not agree. So that's one dichotomy. The other one is that 9 in 10 Democrats felt that this is a difficulty, and only 42% of the Republicans in their research poll felt that this was a priority, and they felt that you should continue with coal and oil production. So what we need to do, I guess, is somehow help our groups to come to more standardized agreement about what the problem is and how we could go about solving it.
Yeah, as easy as it sounds, as it is to say, you know, we need to take the politics out of climate change, which is really hard because especially the groups that are really vested in fossil fuels have made it a political issue. But I have to tell you, I've talked across Montana, in rural Montana, in our larger urban areas, about climate change, and I've never had somebody disagree that it was happening or that it wasn't a problem. I mean, people that have lived in rural areas a long time can see the effects of climate change, and they're actually quite interested in what they should do about it. And they're also interested in trying to understand what some of the decision space is going to be for them ahead. So if we can, you know, talk about drought and heat and wildfire smoke, you know, and take action in those regards, in Montana, I think we're making at least a first step towards progress.
Well, what is happening at Glacier National Park? Over the years, have heard that there's been a lot of melting. What is the status of Glacier?
Well, Glacier is supposed to lose most of its glaciers by the middle of the century. I mean, they're melting at alarming rates, just like glaciers around the world are, but Glacier National Park is kind of our poster child. You know, so many of the glaciers in Glacier National Park and in Grand Teton Park are becoming so small that they're not really functioning as glaciers anymore. They kind of get taken off the list of active glaciers because they're just not functioning like a glacier. They're not moving under their own weight and that sort of thing. So, I mean, Glacier is going to be something that we're going to watch and be depressed at seeing how much ice is being lost there and how we are going to lose most of our glaciers. We may have some remnant permanent ice in protected areas, but most of the big glaciers are on their way out.
Is that over the last half century, or how long has it taken for that to occur?
Yeah, it's been well documented. You can look at historic photos of the changes in glaciers and to see how much they've retreated. And the big warming, you know, really kicked in the 70s and 80s. That's when you really see the temperature curves start to go up. But they were going up steadily before then. I mean, they started going up during the just in the 20th century, and it's as a result of that warming, you know, through the 20th century and now even greater at the end of the 20th century and into this century, that's causing these glaciers to melt at such a rapid pace.
There was something I noticed in Montana that I hadn't noticed over the years. For the last few years, I've noticed that I'll be driving and maybe a large pickup, a diesel pickup, will come by and emit a large bunch of black smoke. And I was thinking, well, they really need to regulate their engine, or there's something, you got bad fuel or whatever. But then I found out that for the most part, that was being done intentionally, that this group are called coal rollers. There's even been the federal government has sued an industry that was making a device you could place on an engine, a diesel engine, to make it do that at will. And then I learned that, well, it's kind of a political statement for some of these people in that they're climate deniers and they want to just kind of look at this. Have you heard of that?
It doesn't surprise me. I know that diesel trucks now, you have to put an additive into your fuel to reduce the emissions. You know, you have to put DEF in, and trucks, new diesel trucks won't even run if they don't have DEF. You can't like decide you're not going to do it. They'll just, the truck will just shut down. So they must have some way of dealing with that that allows them to still blow out black smoke, because you don't see it as much as you used to. It used to be kind of standard for any diesel, but you don't see it so much now, I don't think.
Apparently there was a device that was being sold that's kind of like turning a switch on and off, and they have been fined, at least my last reading on it was $1 million on these people who were selling this device. So it's almost like there's a certain group that says, in your face, we don't believe any of this. That's what I was reading.
Yeah, I read a recent article that the coal rollers actually target electrical vehicles and those that are particularly environmentally savvy or conscious, so and kind of get in front of them and do their coal rolling bit. And also I read about the huge amount of debris that adds to the air quality.
Yeah, it doesn't surprise me, you know. And there's this group of people, the climate deniers, that are, I think, kind of on the fringe of public opinion, but they're not going to do anything to save the planet.
So we need to help those folks, don't we?
Mm-hmm. I almost think those people aren't worth, those aren't the ones we need to talk to. We need to talk to the climate skeptics.
I hear you.
The skeptics who maybe, you know, want to know more and haven't made up their mind and want to do what's right and think about their grandkids.
Yes, please. Yeah, I was really disappointed in the Pew Research that said that older people weren't that concerned, because you would hope that they would be very concerned for the future of all the world's children and our grandchildren. And so we all need to kind of get on board, I think, with this effort and this process.
Yeah, I agree. You know, I think about my own parents. They both passed away, but most of their life, they didn't really see very much global warming. You know, they lived in the 20th century, and they just didn't really see it. And they were, what I would say, were enlightened, educated people, but it just wasn't a big issue for them. Whereas if you look at my trajectory on the temperature curve, I was born in the 1950s, and, you know, hopefully I'll make it to the middle of the century. And I'm on the steep rising temperature curve. And also, no matter what we do now to stop greenhouse gas emissions, that temperature curve is going to happen. I mean, we're in for warming till the middle of the century. And it's really what we do now that determines what will happen in the second half of the 21st century. Will we flatten the temperature curve, or will we decrease it, you know, or will it continue to rise? So we're just in different generations, you know, where my parents weren't thinking too much about it. No matter how much I talk about it, I'm on this warming trajectory, and I worry about my granddaughter, because she's on the steep part of that curve at the end of the century, and I don't know what her world is going to look like.
It's extremely worrisome. And this part of the conversation brings me to a question I mentioned earlier. I'd like to kind of get a quick view of how you got interested in this field, and also if you would recommend to young people, do we need more geoscientists? Do we need more environmental helpers? Could you kind of go over the educational process, the need for those to go into this field? How is that looking? I know that you've been at MSU and as an educator along with your research, Kathy.
Oh, thanks for asking. That's a great question. I've always been a hiker and a backpacker, and I love looking at the environment and trying to figure out how it got put together. You know, how has it always looked this way? How dynamic is it? Why is this particular tree growing here and not there, kind of thing? And so that really got me interested as an earth scientist into looking at long-term environmental change and trying to understand how ecosystems have evolved, particularly since the last ice age. And I came to MSU in 2004 for the main reason that I could have Yellowstone in my backyard, and I could not only do research there, but I could get students there, and we could talk about environmental change being in the last pristine ecosystem in the temperate latitudes. We could be out there talking about it, and I could get students to do research and think about environmental change in important places like Yellowstone. So for me, it's just been this fascinating, I guess, career-long experience of just trying to think about how ecosystems, why they look the way they do. And as I said, I sort of moved into the climate change arena because I knew that I had the background and I had the knowledge and I had the local knowledge that I could speak out and I could make a difference in a way that doesn't come naturally to a lot of scientists. You really, you know, we're quite used to doing our research and working in our own little sphere, and we're not used to going out and talking to the public. So that's been, for me, you know, my career evolution is to be a more public face of an important issue that we all need to think about.
Thank you so much for reaching out. I believe this is scientific data that we all need to become familiar with and act on. And what would you say to young people about entering this field with you, Kathy?
Well, there's so much opportunity for a young person. You know, I don't think it's a time to be depressed about climate change. It's a time to get active. There's so many opportunities in new technology, in working to be sure that there's social justice around issues of climate change, that everyone's dealt with fairly, in helping communities plan and adapt for climate change. Even in the healthcare arena, there's so many opportunities for young people, and we need them. We need their energy, and we need their optimism. So I think it's a great time for a young person to move into this arena. I think whether it's dealing with the technical challenges and getting training in those areas, solar panels, wind farms, that kind of thing, or whether it's, you know, talking to disadvantaged communities and trying to help them understand some of the issues. I was on the trial this summer, the Held versus State of Montana trial. I was an expert witness talking about climate change in Montana. And I was so inspired by those young people and their courage in bringing that state, that case, to the forefront.
Totally impressive, wasn't it? And that was one of the next questions I was going to bring up, is what kind of programs are available in college? What would they look to matriculate? And then how many years? Kind of give a quick view of what preparation would be for this kind of work, Kathy.
Well, I think you can get the preparation you need and study whatever topic you want. So, you know, nursing and public health now is talking about the climate change impacts. Engineering is looking at new technologies to deal with climate change. Earth systems and geography is looking at, you know, understanding how we might find solutions to climate change, or reading the past to better understand how fast ecosystems respond. Every field has areas that you can go into and pursue climate change. And some places, including Montana State University, have minors or certificate programs where students can actually add that onto their transcript that they've gotten training in climate change or in sustainability or in ecosystem resilience, that sort of thing. And so you can add that to your portfolio at almost any university, I believe.
Well, I think I'd like to add another group in there. The psychologists are really addressing what they call eco-anxiety, and it's a new delineation of the American Psychological Association, and they actually have specified training and programs to help people with this particular concern and fear that can be debilitating. And so there's a whole world out there for young people to look to in this topic. Yes, and thank you. I think you've probably trained a bunch of those, haven't you, Kathy?
Well, I hope I've met as many as I can. They all inspire me. Young people just continue to inspire me to keep going forward. And I agree with you that mental health is a huge health consequence of climate change. You know, it puts stress on everyone. Just the uncertainties around climate change put stress on people. And of course, they put a lot of stress on young people who are trying to figure out what their world's going to be like. So we need to pay particular attention to that. And we need to also help healthcare professionals recognize those signs and their relationship to climate change.
Yeah, I was reading an article from Reach Out, a publishing group in Australia. In Australia, 75% of the young people ages 16 to 25 said they were frightened about the future due to climate change, and nearly half said climate anxiety and distress was affecting their daily lives and functioning. I think they might even feel some of the changes in Australia before we do due to their location in the world. And having been there, there are large areas that are dry and tundra-like and that are getting even drier. So, you know, it is something that we've got many different professions, as you pointed out, that we all need to focus and help with this problem.
When I talk to young people, I really try to encourage them to not just fall back into hopelessness, to really think about the opportunities that are there. And I think that's important. I think it's important that people realize that we're not going to go extinct as a species. You know, the world's not going to end. It's just going to be a very, very different world. And so part of that is adapting to that world, and part of it is solving the problem. And we need young people, and I think they'll do fine in the world ahead. It's just going to be a different world.
I think one thing that is maybe confusing to people, and you alluded to it earlier in the history of the world, there have been times when there was an ice age. There have been times when things were very jungle-like and tropical. What caused that to happen over the millennia, the thousands of millions of years, and how's it different than maybe what is happening now?
We've seen climate change throughout Earth's history. You know, it's related to the composition of the atmosphere, and it's also related to the position of the continental plates and the oceans, you know, that affect the whole climate system. It's related to how much volcanism there's been. Climate change is really part of Earth's history. So I don't think we should think that climate change alone is something that we haven't seen. What is different now is the rate of warming. You know, if you look at the last 800,000 years, for example, from ice core records, we can see that temperatures and CO2 have gone up and down in those ice core records about every 100,000 years. We have an ice age, and then we have a period like now, what we call an interglacial, and then another glacial, and so on. And CO2 and temperatures go up and down. What's different now is that we've way exceeded the levels of CO2 in the atmosphere of any of those past periods in the last 800,000 years. You know, we basically almost, you know, double the amount of CO2 compared to an ice age, for example. And that's happened in the last century. And that's something that we've done. And we know it's human caused. We know the source of it, and that's what makes it different than any other period in Earth history. Now, I should say that there's been times in the past when CO2 levels were higher than today. For example, I think when the dinosaurs lived, CO2 levels were higher. It must have been just oppressively hot. But that's not our world, you know, and I don't want to go back and live in the period of the dinosaurs. You know we haven't seen the conditions that we have now in the last 800,000 years from the ice core record. We know that CO2 levels haven't been this high for 3.3 million years. To me, that's enough, like, that we should be concerned.
So we could absolutely say with certainty that we're not seeing a normal fluctuation.
No, no. You know, in the ice ages, going back to Arlo's question, they're caused by variations in incoming solar radiation that are related to the wobble of the Earth's axis and changes in the circularity of the Earth's orbit around the sun. These are regular variations. That's why every 100,000 years we have an ice age. We've had an ice age. It's because of these changes in orbital variations and how that affects incoming solar radiation. So that has nothing to do with greenhouse gases, and it takes place much slower than what we're seeing now.
On the movie Day After Tomorrow, is that totally fictional?
Well, there's parts of it that are not, that are sort of grounded in truth, you know, the changes in ocean circulation that are likely to happen with global warming and may already be happening, that'll change the temperatures in places like New York City and the Arctic. Those are all kind of based on our understanding of how ice ages work and how we go in and out of ice ages. So that part is, you know, has truth in it. What's not true is sort of the speed at which that'll happen. That's not true.
What about the big ice sheet that's broken off from Antarctica, which is, has that happened before? And when it did, how long ago was that?
I can't give you an exact number on that. It probably has happened during some of the warmer interglacial periods in the past. The speed at which it's happening again is what's alarming and seems to exceed, you know, anything that we've seen in the recent record. And these are big floating ice shelves that are, you know, breaking off, and then because the ocean is warmer, they melt really quickly.
And what isn't that one as big as, is it Rhode Island or Delaware? It's a huge, or maybe even bigger.
Yeah, I know it. It's you know, it's shocking. The big change in sea level will come as the land-based glaciers start to flow into the ocean. You know, that's what's really going to change sea level. These ice shelves are sort of in equilibrium with sea level. So you think about an ice cube in a glass of water. When it melts, it doesn't really change the level of the water. And so that's like an iceberg, doesn't really change, but it's when you start adding water from the continents, from Antarctica and Greenland, that you really affect sea level.
You know, Kathy, I've been hearing lots of people almost jokingly talk about this fall in Montana, that global warming has come to Montana this fall. No snow, hardly any rain. It's just not like the Montana we're used to. How unusual and unique is this fall?
I haven't seen all the data on it. I mean, it strikes me, and it sounds like it strikes you as well, but it's pretty unusual that we just don't have any snow right now. We are in a El Nino condition, which is a condition in the atmosphere in the ocean that happens every few years. And so that's kind of making it, that has the potential to make it drier in Montana. It doesn't always, but it has that potential. And so some of what we're seeing is related to that, and a lot of it's related to global warming, I suspect. But it's really important that people not think of any year or any fire or any flood as by itself being solely caused by global warming. Global warming is a trend that is measured on 30 years. You know, it's the trend in temperature, it's the trend in snowpack. It's not a year to year variability. So I think what I would say is what we're seeing now is completely consistent with what you'd expect with global warming. But there's other factors going on in the climate system.
If the changes of global warming go on their expected, if there is an expected timeline, I've seen maps that show, well, if the ocean receives enough water from melting ice, it would rise an X number of feet, then these cities would be catastrophically affected. I think that that includes New Orleans, Miami, part of New York, perhaps. Can you expound on that a little bit?
Well, more worrying to me are the large population centers around the world.
Like Bangladesh?
Yeah. Bangladesh, you know, Hong Kong, most of the major global cities are really on the coast. And so they're all going to be affected. And places like Bangladesh, you know, one of the poorest countries in the world, you know, they just don't have the wherewithal to deal with these kinds of changes. You can already see how Miami is adjusting, and some of these other places, people just move inland. In some places, there's actually assisted migration where they're relocated to a safer, higher elevation area. We have the wherewithal in the U.S., I think, to, you know, we'll respond and we'll do what we can, but other countries just don't. And think about the island nations. They have nowhere to go as sea level rises and submerges their communities.
It just makes you wonder, what are we going to do with all of these people in those lower-lying areas? They're going to need somewhere to go. And we possibly need to start planning for that. You know, on a little bit of a brighter note, if there is a bright note, I'd like to maybe ask you, what are some of the things, and I found a few things, but that we could begin to do, we don't have a lot of time left, that we as individuals listening to this information, give us some hints of things that we could do to help with this.
I think we all need to think about our carbon footprint and where we're using fossil fuels changes. So, you know, the biggest use of fossil fuels is for power, for electricity, and for heat. You know, it frustrates me that there's so much building in Bozeman, and I don't see a single solar panel on any of these new apartments. I just do not understand that, because to have solar panels. In the same way, you know, where are you burning natural gas in your house, and where could you make changes? Now, right away, or the next time you have to buy a new appliance? And then the vehicle you buy, I think in the next 5 years, we're going to see more and more options in electric vehicles and hybrid vehicles. And, you know, those are the points that we should be thinking about making decisions, either deliberately now, which would be the best, or just as decisions need to be made down, you know, in the next few years. I also think about how much I travel. I used to travel a lot to meetings in Washington, D.C., or New York. You know, they'd be 2-day meetings or day and a half meetings where everybody would fly in, and now I don't do that. I do not travel for such a short event because my carbon footprint is just too great. And often I'm going to a meeting where we're talking about climate change. You know, so how can you justify it? So I think a lot of self-examination about where we're using fossil fuels and how we can reduce it. The other thing I think we need to do is think about in our populations, in our communities. These tend to be people with health issues, the old and the very young, people who live in poverty, people who live far from services, people who work outdoors. They include our reservations, where our Native Americans are. They include the parts of our cities that often don't have trees or don't have easy places to go to get out of the heat. We need to really think about those sectors of our population that are going to need help as climate change continues, and who will be most vulnerable to things like climate extremes and climate-related disasters.
I've noticed a lot of talk from the city and the state even about water resources and maintaining and keeping them. But yet, with all the building, and you referenced it, that the grass seems to still be what they put in rather than perhaps rock or stone or water plants that don't use as much water. I would hope there would be a greater, at least local policy on that.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. I mean, it's silly to think about lawns. And, you know, I think my understanding is the city sort of feels like its hands are tied and the state won't let them do more, be more, have stronger laws than the state would allow. That needs to change. That's just crazy. Bozeman should be a leader in this area. And they could show the rest of the state how to do it.
And we've had city commissioners on several who've highlighted that there is a lot of building going on, but not commensurate planning necessarily for the water resources they will be needing for those expanded communities and households. So we need a lot more concern in this area, it seems.
Yeah, I agree completely. And I'd love to see solar panels on those new apartments. That really bothers me a lot.
In every home, you know, we could really work toward that. And the research also that I ran across shows that any effort made toward helping with this problem, some of the things you're discussing and mentioning here, helps the mental health of those who are highly concerned about the environment. So part of our fear here could be annulled somewhat by getting busy and doing what we can do and helping others do what they can do to begin addressing this problem, a serious problem.
Yeah, I agree. I agree 100% that doing something is a really good solution to doing nothing.
And some of the suggestions were as simple as using energy-efficient light bulbs and water-saving shower heads and only using air conditioning and heating when necessary. And you can reduce, reuse, recycle. You can use public transport or carpool. One thing that was very helpful for mental health in this area was getting outside and growing fruits and veggies, being outside in the outdoors and taking care of it. You can buy vintage and minimize all the huge buying of fast fashion and trying environmentally friendly diets with less meat and compost all of your food waste. Just a few things there that might help. And so
I agree. The more we can do local, the better off we're going to be.
We'd like to thank you for being with us today. This has been terrific. Any final words you'd like to say to the listening audience?
Well, I think climate change, and it's not a generational challenge. It's a challenge we all face, and we need to do something in the next 10 to 15 years if we're going to help the next generation, our kids and grandkids, have the experiences that we've had.
I totally agree. We really, really appreciate the work that you're doing, and we'd love to have you on again. This has been very educational. And I would say to our listening audience, thank you for listening to Health and Happiness. Continue to tune in to KGVM 95.9 or KGVM.org. You could even go and listen to old programs going through the archives. Thank you, and we'll talk to you later.